You're listening to the Physio Matters podcast in association with rehabmypatient.com, and this is session 83. Welcome back to the Physio Matters podcast. I'm still Jack Chu. Thanks a lot to everyone that's given us some feedback for the acute low back pain episode with Michelle Angers from last month. Bit of a barnstormer, certainly really moved a lot of people, moved a lot of commentary. Certainly that's what we want to be doing, is provoking some discussion, but certainly the vast majority of feedback coming through, very popular episode indeed. And so thanks to Michelle and thanks to you all for listening and for feeding back. One thing that's a bit of housekeeping, I guess, for us, just to clarify that Therapy Live Sport, when, by the time you're listening to this, likely to be sold out, but the Therapy Live website is now up and running, and we are able to control more of the variables this time, you know, decrease glitches, and also just centralize the content. So therapy-live.co.uk, go and have a drive around the website. You'll also notice that there's a Therapy Live Physio Matters Plus membership that we're doing now, which at £5 a month gets you access to all the content produced by Physio Matters and Therapy Live at every event on a monthly subscription basis, no contract. We are confident we'd be able to retain your interest by feeding you the best and brightest. You'll get access to episodes early of Physio Matters. You get hot takes, transcripts, translations, but also everything that Therapy Live produces, you get first access to tickets of all four shows of next year, as well as then all the content that's recorded at those events. And so, yeah, we're pretty confident that's a good CPD offering. If you like what we're doing and you want to support us and also keep things like Physio Matters and Therapy Live free at the point of live access, then hopefully you'll join us on Physio Matters Plus. So do check it out at therapylive.co.uk or, sorry, therapy-live.co.uk or physio-matters.com. Many thanks as ever to rehabmypatient.com, our loyal sponsors. We're pleased to be working with what we consider to be the leading platform for exercise prescription. In this age, we need it to be simple. We need it to have a good digital interface. We need to move past sheets and handouts of exercises that aren't versatile or can't be individualized to patients with ease. rehabmypatient.com/physio-matters gets you a free trial, so please do not hesitate to check them out because you will be pleased with what you find. Certainly people that we're pleased to work with, really innovative company that we're looking forward to working with into 2021, we can confirm, including through Therapy Live, so you'll be seeing lots more of them, but please do check them out if you haven't already. And thanks again to rehabmypatient.com for their support of the show. So today's show is, we've been wanting to do this for a long time. It's like a performing arts dance episode. I think it's one of the most challenging patient sets that we can think about, and also just provides a number of different challenges with what they're asking of their bodies. And so when sometimes put through a standard MSK lens, it doesn't really apply very well. Some of the principles do, of course, but generally speaking, it takes a bit of a closer look. And so we've been thinking about how we could approach that. And finally, we recognize that Liz Bailey was the perfect person to do that. She'll explain a little bit about her background and as a dancer as well as a physio. And so it's just a fascinating exploration, this conversation, as to lots of the oohs and ahs, especially very practically relevant. You know, we do talk, of course, about some what the evidence informs us of and what logic and reason brings us to understand. But generally, it's great to sort of talk about her job and experience, both as a dancer and then as a therapist to dancers and performing artists in musical theatre and what that means. So certainly really pleased to bring you this episode. And so here is Liz Bailey. I'm delighted to be here today with Liz Bailey, discussing a topic that's been on our shortlist for a long time, and we've just never really thought of either the person, or I think we've maybe not been brave enough to wade into this space because we're often thinking in MSK and in sport terms, and sometimes even leaning on things that we've done in the past as people and as athletes. Means I'm not much of a dancer, I'm certainly not an actor, I've even dabbled in singing before and made that mistake, but generally speaking, not an area that we've any expertise on, but a really important area when we see patients that work in that space and start to have goals in that area, that there's certain parameters around performance arts and the rehabilitation of those people, athletes, that we really need to be considerate on. And so we've been wanting to do a Physio Matters episode on this. And so when I then realized that we have regular interactions with Liz Bailey on social media and that she's very thoughtful on this topic, that it was just a perfect opportunity to get her on the show. Liz, can you introduce yourself to the listeners? And thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Jack. I'm really happy to be here too, because I've listened to the podcast since it started. So it's really nice to be part of it and to be asked. So hopefully I won't let the team down. I thought it'd be interesting to talk about my life as a dancer and also as a physio, because it's relevant, isn't it? So if we start from the beginning, I started dancing when I was 3, like many people do. And I trained in exclusively ballet until I was 16. And then I did a little bit of jazz and modern. I don't know if that means much to people, but it's another type of dance, until I was 18. And then I had to make that decision. Do I go to theatre school or do I go to university and do something academic? And I've always been pretty sensible and eventually decided to go and do a psychology degree at Sussex University. So I didn't dance, but I kept dancing while I was there. So I was at university in Brighton, used to get the train up to London to do advanced professional classes in London. So I was a really advanced dancer by that point, but I just decided to do the degree because I felt like it would probably be a good thing to do for the future and that dancing could still wait another 3 years. So when I finally graduated, I thought, right, if I'm ever going to do it, this is the time. So I went to London, did lots of auditions and was really fortunate, got lots of jobs, and basically had a 15-year career as a professional dancer. So to give you some examples of the kind of things I did that you would be familiar with, probably the most famous one would be the Moulin Rouge in Paris, which is the big cabaret show. So it's an absolute killer of a contract to do, because you do a can-can dance in it and you do 12 shows a week, which is a lot of dancing. So even in the West End, you'll do 8 shows a week. So we were doing 2 shows every single night and each show is about 3 hours long. So we're not on stage the whole time, but we're on stage a lot of that time, and we're doing the can-can, which broke me and probably opened up my interest in physiotherapy, actually, or in injuries. Right. I did lots of other work. A lot of it was abroad. I ended up getting a dance partner, and we specialised in Latin and ballroom and Argentine tango, which is the kind of thing you see on Strictly. Most people know what that is now because they get to see on Strictly. Yeah. So I ended up doing that for the biggest proportion of my dancing years, I would say. And I lived on a cruise ship for 4 years. Wow. Doing that, or different cruise ships for around 4 years. So you would dance and teach in the day and then you'd dance at night, that kind of thing. It was good money, it was nice conditions, so that's a good option as a dancer. So if you've got that option, it's great. And we made that work for us. That was really good. We came back to London in 2008 and we were approached by Strictly to potentially be one of the professional couples in Strictly. Right. And that ended up falling through, which made me kind of think, right, okay, what am I going to do with my life? I'm going to have to stop dancing eventually. And I'd been thinking about being a teacher or a physio, and physio was always the thing that appealed to me. And because I had my BA in psychology, I wanted to do a master's in physio. I didn't want to do another 3-year degree.
Sure.
But no one would take me. So I had a BA in psychology.
All them.
Yeah, well, no, at the time, I think they were probably right. I had an arts degree, even though it was in psychology. I had no other physiotherapy experience at all, and no science A levels. So what I ended up doing was a sports therapy advanced diploma. I actually did it in Manchester. So I don't know if it was near to where you guys are, but that lasted about a year. So that taught me basic anatomy, a little bit of exercise prescription, physiology, loads of hands-on work, so sports, massage, mobilizations, joint assessments, all kind of a pretty basic level, I would say now, but you know, good enough that you can get into the industry in that way and work. So once I was graduated in that, I had all the contacts and I went and worked in theatre straight away. So I had loads and loads of patients because I had all those contacts. I got a job with a big physiotherapy company as a sports therapist. So they would send me backstage to the big shows in the West End. So I was working in things like Jersey Boys, Matilda, Wicked, Singing in the Rain, all of them, basically Chicago, Chorus Line. So I was backstage working with the performers on that. And then I was still dancing in the day myself as well. And I was teaching. So I was doing a little bit of both.
Right.
And while I was seeing all these different injuries, I was kind of, because it's the kind of person I am, I suppose, I would kind of think, oh, I don't know about that. So I'd read up on it. And I slowly was getting frustrated because I realized that I was at the bottom of the pile when it came to, diagnostics and the more advanced stuff. I knew someone had patellar femoral pain syndrome, but I wasn't able to diagnose it, you know, because it just wasn't what I was trained to do. And I thought, no, I need to take this further. So I started delving into stuff with, to do with physiotherapy so I could get on the master's. So I got a job at the Falls and Bone Health Service in Battersea as an exercise facilitator and worked in the community with people who were at risk of falling. I started teaching Parkinson's patients tango. So it was tango for balance, which is really interesting. So I got to a lot of exposure to people with neurological conditions. I got loads of other experience, you know, shadowing and going to hospitals and doing respiratory, well, shadowing respiratory work. So I'd really be able to say, I know what it's all about. And it must have worked because I finally got onto the MSc pre-reg at King's in 2014. So graduated from that and then had to make the decision, do I go into rotations or do I go back to what I know and what I've already got contacts in? And I ended up doing that partly because I was offered a job at a private sports injury clinic in Ascot who were kitted up with all the same stuff that you'd see in a big dance company. So that's all the Pilates reformers, the trapeze tables, the chairs. We had three different studios in this clinic and I just thought it just couldn't have been more perfect for me, really. I'd already done Pilates. I didn't know how to use the equipment. They were offering me some lovely kind of CPD, lots of supervision. I thought, yeah, okay, that's what I'm going to go with. It just suited me better. And I think it was the right decision. So I've worked with them ever since I graduated and obviously become a senior physio and worked my way up through that. I've also worked in theatres as a physiotherapist now, not as a sports therapist, through my contacts. And I work with a theatre company called the MTA, which is the Musical Theatre Academy in North London, which is quite a small theatre school. It's about 50 students altogether over 2 years, but it's an exceptional school. It's won Stage School of the Year twice since they've been open. So I work alongside the mental health nurse and counsellor there. We've got a nutritionist, that kind of thing. And so that kind of forms my day-to-day work now. So that's a long answer.
But, it's important for us to
give you an idea of what I do. Yeah,
well, no, that's brilliant. And I'm really glad that you did that, because had you have doubled down on the professional, I'd have picked into the backstory, because it's incredible to hear about. And obviously you've been able to give lots of detail there. I can't help but ask, the intense sort of a competitive performance aspect that will have made you high performance and elite athlete in your space. Mm-hmm. I can't help but recognize that drive then throughout, you know, when you've had an idea or you've sought after going up and doing something different with a career sense. Do you feel that that is a dispositional mindset thing, or is it coincidence? Yeah. You know,
I think it is
a pattern there to me.
Yeah, no, I think it is. I think it also shows you that I think performers are really driven and ambitious. You have to be, because you're always, I've never not been self-employed, basically. So you have to make things happen. And I think actually getting onto the MSc was almost more of a success for me than passing the MSc, because it was so unlikely them to take me on, especially somewhere like King's, which was really, it was a fantastic course. So that was such a big deal for me to have finally gotten on it. And I just knew that if I dedicated and went and did enough experience, if I could get the interview, I could probably get the place, and it worked. But I do think that's a trait that performers have. And I think that you're seeing it now, what with all the COVID stuff in theatres, that kind of resilience, flexibility, that drive to succeed is coming out in them. They've all been made jobless. They're all unemployed, but they're all making it work in some respect. And it's really,
even I've seen that incredible sort of levels of entrepreneurship and creativity that's sort of flowing out of them. So it seems the case. I love the idea of you saying to a physio school, look, just give me a chance. I just want the audition. I mean, interview.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
No, that's brilliant. I'm so pleased. And it's for all of our gains, really, especially with you now coming on here, as well as your contributions to this space. And the way in which, as well, you know, and this is going to come through, no doubt, through the interview, is just the way in which you are interpreting what are sort of versatile learning skill sets through conditioning, as well as rehab, as well as the sort of biopsychosocial framework in which we view things to this side of it, which sometimes is an area in which people sometimes, I would argue, and I'm sure we'll talk about it, potentially overindulge on very specific things, be that biomechanics, etc., or flexibility, etc., which we'll visit. Thank you for sort of the big overview you've been able to give us there, and also it gives people an insight into where we're going to probably go in this conversation, which is that we're going to hit some specifics, but also there's so much applicability to this. Even if people don't see a lot of these sorts of athletes or even hobbyists, then the principles are fascinating, especially with regards to those, all those biopsychosocial elements. So where I'd like to start, if that's okay, is to talk about dance in a relevance of terminology front, as well as the sort of injury profiles and classic sort of typical things that we see or need to consider, not just in the sort of specialized setting, but also in a general MSK front, if that's okay.
Okay. So if we think about, let's go with the type of injuries you see and the incidence of injuries is a good one to go with. So it's widely acknowledged that dancers get injured regularly, probably more regularly than their other athletic counterparts. The figure of like 80% of dancers will get injured within a year is thrown around sometimes. But if you look at the evidence, there's been various bits and pieces done study-wise. There's quite a nice little study that was done in a big ballet company. So ballet is almost a dance style unto itself. It is different from the other dance styles. It's very, it's sort of special in that way. And a lot of the research into dance is done in ballet companies because they have in-house medical teams that are available to do it. So sometimes the dance evidence is skewed a bit on the ballet, towards ballet, because they're the people that are doing the research, basically. Mm. But if you look at, let's take a ballet company. It's a big ballet company up in the north. This was done in over 1 year. And they looked at injury incidents. And they found that for 1,000 hours of dance, there were 4.4 injuries, which doesn't really mean that much to me. But if you take it in this way, so for each dancer, that was 6.8 injuries per dancer per year, which is a lot. And this is this is looking at time loss, not just injury and dancing through it. This is actually having to take time off because of the injury.
Sure. Yeah.
So
these are injuries they're not carrying, if we were to call it that they can still perform on, that are niggles maybe, if we call it that.
Yeah, exactly. This is actually causing them to take time off. The average length of time off, I think, was about 7 days. And when you look at the type of injury, overuse injuries are really prominent. So in male dancers, it's about 60%. This is in this particular study. Mm-hmm. And in female dancers, it's 68%. Wow. So overuse injuries are really, really, really common. So now if you look at dancers that aren't that elite level ballet dancer, there's also studies been done with them as well. And they tend to show slightly less incidence of injury, but still very high. But they also show that with specialist dance intervention, medical interventions, it can be reduced quite significantly.
Right.
So we know that by having medical teams to help dancers, it does significantly improve their outcomes, basically.
Specificity is really relevant there, because that's one of the things that people wonder, and definitely something I want to visit with you, is with regards to how much utility a generalist can have, and is it more of a do no harm if you end up in with someone like this? You know, I've had that myself, but again, I want to revisit that probably later as to how specific do we need to be, etc. But so we talk about incidence, what about type?
Yeah, so the type of injuries, obviously we're looking at lower limb injuries are always going to be the most prominent ones. So if you look at, from the evidence we've got, it looks like female dancers tend to get low back and nerve root type injuries more, and male dancers would tend to get more calf strains and subacromial pain. And that kind of perfectly matches the kind of requirements that, I mean, everyone does a little bit of everything in dance, but females tend to do a lot more cambrés or back bends. Males tend to do a lot more elevation, ballistic type movements and partnering work. So that kind of matches perfectly with what you might expect. But they also get just the same old injuries that everyone would get. Well, you know, bad backs, neck spasms, shoulder pain, hip impingement, that kind of thing. The other thing, but the key thing with dancers, I suppose, is the prominence of foot and ankle injuries. But again, you're going into ballet more a little bit, probably. The really high levels of foot and ankle injuries happen because of dancing on points.
Sure.
Which you're really not going to see unless you're working with a ballet company. So I know for a fact that dancers go to NHS outpatient services, because they did when I was a student. So even when I was, some of my MSK placements were at St Thomas's in Waterloo, and I saw probably four different dancers. I saw a yoga teacher, I saw a gymnast, and they were all given to me because of my background. So they definitely walk in, they're referred by GPs just to normal MSK services. So even if you're not a dance physio, you probably will see dancers and performers, because I did when I was a student in the NHS.
Yeah.
And I think if you ever want to specifically work with dancers, it's really important that you learn about terminology that dancers use. But if you have a dancer sitting in front of you and you've never come across it before, I think you just have to treat them like you would with anything that was unfamiliar. Like if I had, say, a golfer come to me, I've never played golf before, you can kind of find some common ground with them. Oh yeah, my uncle plays golf, whatever it is, and kind of form that relation. The therapeutic relationship's really important, just to, for them to understand that you're open to what they do and that you understand there might be something special about it and different is probably enough. You don't necessarily have to use the right terminology, but I think you have to remember, if you're seeing a dancer but you're not a dancer, they're the expert in their field, but you're still the expert in your field. So you know about anatomy, physiology, injury prevention, healing times, and you can still give them all of that information, even if you have, even if you don't know exactly what a double pirouette into a Bronchetti en tonneau is, you know?
No. Yeah, so, they need to spell that out and or show you a video.
Yeah, exactly.
In order for us to work that.
But through. you can get the dancers to say they got injured doing a grand battement. I'm presuming you wouldn't know what a grand battement was. It's basically a high kick. Yeah, it's just a high kick. So say they've got a hamstring strain from doing a grand battement. So yeah, you don't know what that is, but you can ask them to show you. Show it to me online. Tell me what it is. Can you show me on the other leg? If you show an interest in what they do and are really open to it, I think dancers really like that, and they appreciate that not everyone knows exactly what they do on that kind of level.
It weighs in a little bit on this point that I referred to earlier, where if, say, there was a dancer of a high level that then was, say, in an emergency department because they had a query fracture, right? So that was an appropriate place for them to go. They'd come through and say that they were seeing someone that was then, they'd been appropriately reassured that they hadn't got a fracture, or even say that they have or something. But it's just that this is an area where I think that I've seen a lot of second opinion stuff that's come through this way, that there's a dancer that's then been told by a generalist something that has been quite a bold call for them to make, which is that, you know, certainly don't dance on point for that for 6 weeks, or for them to, you know, this is not something to be, you know, run on it but don't dance on it, and there's some real quite bold calls that have not been appropriate necessarily for the expertise that seemed of the clinician, from what we can tell, and that's still sometimes scarred a dancer in various ways. And I'm seeing them many months later, of course, then trying to unpick this. One of the questions I had then is how careful do generalists need to be in this space compared to sometimes other sporting disciplines, where it maybe matters less that they know less about lacrosse than they do rugby because there's more transferable principles? It feels like this is an area that is, we need to be just extra careful. I don't know.
Yeah. I think what you're describing, I've seen happen on numerous occasions. I saw one dancer that had it was a patella tendinopathy, but it just wasn't managed particularly well at the time. It escalated and it got really, really bad, acute on chronic, and then it degenerated and then all kinds. And he was dancing through it. This was on a stage in the West End. He really should have been taken off. When I look back at this with my physio head, this is back when I was a sports therapist. Okay. But he continued to dance on it. He wanted to work, and no one was sort of there to say, no, you must stop because this is going to get much worse, and we can rehab it, but you need to stop now. He eventually ended up getting sent to a surgeon who did a microfracture on it. Okay. So you're adding insult to injury, literally. He didn't need that. What you probably needed was some really good isometric work, you know, or some heavy, slow resistance, and to stop doing the thing that was causing the problem. But that didn't happen at the time. And that particular surgeon said, yeah, you'll never dance again. And this is a friend of mine who I worked with as a dancer, but I also worked with him later when I was a physio on one of the West End shows. And he phoned me in tears because he'd been told by a guy in a white coat that he would never dance again. And this is his life. This, you know, I don't know me not being a dancer. I started when I was three before I even had memories, and he was the same.
So identity.
Yeah, I think you often hear this, where I don't want to tar everyone with the same brush, but orthopedic surgeons who'll make comments like that kind of off the cuff because they're thinking very structurally, they might not be thinking quite so psychosocially, and they do make comments that I think they underestimate the effect it'll have on dancers, on people, on patients, on other people, other athletes, but particularly on dancers, because if you tell a dancer they'll never dance again, it's catastrophic. So, and no matter what I said to that guy, it never came out of his head. So it's a hard one once it's been said to undo. And I think that, for example, so you were saying something like if someone in A&E says, oh, you shouldn't dance on point, blah, blah, blah. I wonder if anyone would actually say that, because that's quite a big call to make, isn't it? Like, I wonder if they would sort of feel qualified to make that decision. I think if you're looking at a dancer that's doing, say, point work, they usually have, well, they'll be in a school with hopefully really good dance teachers that can help guide them a little bit, but they would need definitely specialist physiotherapy for something like point work. So we're going, if you think about ballet being almost like a subsection of dance, because it is so different and the demands are particularly tough in certain areas, particularly point work, you're definitely going to want to get someone who has worked with dancers to make those kind of calls. And yeah, and really specific rehab, really, really specific for foot strength and placement and all of that kind of thing. Yeah.
When it comes to the behavior, I want to move us towards like the sort of, we talked about classic types, classic cases and stuff, and we're purposely being general here because we could do a podcast, no doubt, on posterior ankle pain of the ballerina, right?
Yeah.
But we're not doing that, right? We're going big picture, and no doubt, you know, as long as you don't fall out with me, we'll do something again on something maybe more specific in the future. But in this instance, I want to sort of talk about sort of what sort of behavioural characteristics there are, say, of dancers in terms of their health-seeking behaviour. So what treatments they particularly like, what sort of relationship they have with health professionals, or I'm trying to think of the term, whether there's certain professionals in a coaching therapy space that sort of sometimes between medicine and performance, you know, it's like, what's the sort of culture like in that regard?
Yeah, I think in a way it feels like kind of what I used to do. So I was kind of that person. I was like between medicine and performance, because I wasn't medically trained as a sports therapist. I was, you know, trained in manual therapy and things like that. So if you're looking at like, so health-seeking behaviours and dancers, that kind of thing, I suppose as a culture, I think it's getting much, much better in dance. I think that kind of understanding of the importance of strength, control, cross-training is starting to get through to younger dancers. But I think as a culture, we're still really heavily reliant on what we would probably call the less evidence-based type stuff, you know? So, and I think dancers say, oh yeah, I get a massage weekly because it stops me from getting injured. And I kind of roll my eyes and think, oh, that's what I used to think when I was a dancer. You know, I always think I wish I knew what I knew now when I was performing 12 shows a week. I'd have been a stronger dancer, a better dancer. I would have enjoyed it more. My career probably would have lasted longer.
We should have had a Dance Matters podcast. Is this what you're telling me?
Yeah. Oh yeah. 100%. It would have helped. I think, so what am I trying to say? So I think, so there's a really heavy reliance on things like massage, adjuncts, foam rolling, manual therapy in order to keep dancers going. Mm-hmm. And I think, like I said, I think there's also, now the balance is coming up, and I think that dancers are starting to understand the importance of strength and training in their programs of work, particularly in the higher levels. I think like when you see the big ballet companies, they've got all the equipment that I already described. They've got weights rooms. They've got, dancers are in there doing proper strength training, really low levels of repetitions with really high weight. And they're kind of buying into that. Yeah. And I think, does that answer your question?
The types of relief that they're seeking through massage, manual therapy, foam rolling, yeah, other adjunctive care, etc., that does seem to differ somewhat across sporting sectors. So, for example, in the rugby game, you do get some of that, but actually, you see them sometimes they're over medicating pain relief. They're having jabs left, right, and centre to manage certain conditions. And so even though of a similar behaviour in a sense that they're trying to get some sort of relief alongside rehab, there are different sort of subcultures in which some things are popular and not. In this instance with dancers, is that something that is just a cultural association to those things? Like you mentioned, I used to think that. Like what was it that made you be in that space? Was it a perception of what it was doing and how it was managing, maintaining you? Or was it more just that you didn't really care where the relief came from? It was just part of how you sort of felt better about yourself.
Yeah, I think it was just lack of education, 100%. And I mean, bear in mind, so I never went to theatre school, but we're talking nearly 20 years ago. And I think that theatre schools now are coming up to date a bit, and they're getting people like me in to talk to their performers about healthcare, strength training, injury prevention. So it's something that I do with the MTA students. So I go in when they're first years, and we have a big chat about why would you get injured? How would you stop that? What would you do if you did? You know, all of that stuff. So I think back when I was a dancer, it was just, I just didn't know. really. And I the funny thing was that if I did do something like yoga on the side, I would perform better. My back would bend more easily. I would feel stronger. I would kick higher. But I never really put two and two together that that might be why. I don't know why. I think in a way, I think my problem was, especially when you're doing 12 shows a week, is I thought, oh no, I have to rest. So if I'm not dancing, I should be resting. But in actual fact, rest is really important. But what I should have been doing was maybe two or three times doing a week, doing some cross training. So strength training, yeah. Working.
Just something different.
Something different. Yeah. Something different. So even though I was physically knackered, also you're quite nocturnal doing that job. So I wouldn't get to bed till maybe like 3 in the morning. So it's really hard on your system, because once you finish a show, say, I think we'd finish a show about 1 in the morning. So by the time you'd taken makeup off, had a shower, walked home, eaten something, it was nearly 3 a.m. by the time you got to bed, by the time you'd wound down. So the environmental factors, they're not very cohesive to good health, I suppose. You kind of just want to lay in late, get up and then go to work and get through the show. But I think if I'd had someone's, well, education at some point, or if I'd, you know, gotten this maybe when I was doing my training, actually, if you cross train, if you improve your strength, your control, your proprioception, your balance, all of those things, you'll actually get through the shows easier and you won't be as tired. I just didn't know that. That's the message that I try to give to dancers and performers when I speak to them now. So whenever I speak to my first years at the MTA, that's a key message for sure. Right. I just wanted to give you an example of how insane dancers are. There's this one just, it's a good example so that people understand what I mean. So I was working backstage at a show, and before the shows happened, the dancers were on the stage warming up, and I could hear a load of kind of screaming, but it was from the boys in the cast. And I was asking what was going on, and that what they were doing was rolling out their ITB on a metal bar. And the reason was to see who could give themselves the biggest bruise, basically. I mean, it was insane. I was like, but why are you doing that? It's not just to get the biggest bruise, surely. And they said, oh no, it's because apparently it's good for our knees, you know? And I mean, how do you even begin to address that? But that's the kind of mentality that you get. So they feel like, so no pain, no gain is something that I try and teach dancers. So actually, when you go for a massage, it doesn't have to be agonizing for it to work, or you don't have to do things to the point that you feel like you're going to break to make a difference. I think that dancers have this incredibly high pain threshold, and they like to push themselves into it for good or for bad, you know.
They're quite used to training themselves and the tissues then in that space, that it sort of makes it normalized to them, and therefore they make those associations then with the treatment that they're getting, that they need to have someone else strain their body in that direction.
Yeah, and the classic, and this was something I thought really at the time, I'm sure you'll remember this. Remember recently on Twitter there was that whole thing with Dame Kelly Holmes?
Yes.
You remember when she was having her, there was that tiny cupping on her, like around the Achilles tendon, and the therapist was working the foot into plantar flexion, dorsiflexion, and everyone was up in arms because it just put such a bad message out there for the public. And my first reaction was, God, dancers would love that. because they kind of would, I think, but I think it... Yeah, I think it kind of carries through. I think that elite level of sport, and you saw in the comments on Twitter, it was the elite sports physios that were kind of advocating it and saying, yeah, but it gives them the extra inch, or it gets them to run that second faster. And I think it's really rife in elite sport, and I think dance is part of that.
Yeah, it's certainly those sorts of things are fraught with challenges, whereby the big issue I end up taking is that there's such a difference in opinion in the professions and industry at large in MSK and sport about what are we trying to achieve with something like that. You know, it wasn't that they were making an argument that, oh, we're doing this as a part, you know, it was a perception that those modalities were doing something, and that therefore the pain was a side effect that was necessary to make those differences to tissues. So that mechanism of effect conversation just seems to get lost sometimes in the whether or not it was polite to bring that up type discussion. So yeah, it was a fascinating one, and I'm not surprised. Yeah, I can think of even just dancers that I've worked with, which of course are few and far between compared to your experience. But yeah, they sometimes that way out, that they're wanting to grimace no matter what it is you're doing, whether that's rehabbing or any manual work with them. I want to ask a little bit about sort of a lifestyle and the medical overlay to that lifestyle, factors that can affect things, be that at different levels of dance. And I also feel like I may overindulge stereotypes that aren't appropriate here, but I'll just sort of throw some out there because some of them are associations that might be relevant and others might be ones that we need to bust those myths. But this sort of, particularly around the physique that's required of many dancers means that sometimes there's associations to, say, not even total eating disorders, but some issues there with regards to nutrition and the anaerobic factors, athlete triad, stress fractures because of the high load, as a lot plus or minus smoking. So I'm saying a lot there. I just want to just throw out a few things there that sort of can be a cluster of things. Is that something that's a bit of an old stereotype that's actually wasn't actually that fair ever, or is it something that is a key variable for us to need to consider when someone might present?
That's interesting. So I think the body image, the body weight and the red S type problems are probably more rife in ballet.
Okay.
This is probably from my, because my experience is far more West End and musical theatre. Although I've shadowed at big ballet companies. I'm in touch with physios and big ballet companies. I've done work for them, but I definitely am much more musical theatre. So the body type that you see in musical theatre really isn't, and the desirable body type really isn't that stick thin thing that is difficult to achieve and that you might have to change your nutrition to achieve. So if you look at ballet students, that's where I'd say that was more of a risk factor. So I don't really see it much in the industry that I work in that part of it. But I don't think that that's an old fashioned sort of stereotype. I think it is something that still is a problem and still needs to be monitored really carefully. And something that I would talk about, but I know that you did, there was a Red S podcast, wasn't there, by Anna, which she covered brilliantly. And I couldn't add anything to that, but everything she said is also applicable to dancers.
Okay.
As well. So that's one thing that would be the body type and the eating disorder, the red S type challenges. The smoking thing is interesting, and in my personal experience I can tell you how I saw this change over 15 years that I was a dancer. So when I first started, everyone smoked. I never did, actually. I was always far too sensible. But
the halo from here, yeah.
When I say everyone smoked, a lot of people smoked. I remember you'd have, I don't know, 8 out of 12 would probably smoke. By the time I finished, I think you'd be pushed to find a smoker in a cast of dancers. Genuinely. Right. It's amazing how much it changed. Mm. So I think, I don't know what that's about. I don't know if it's to do with just in general, the message about how bad smoking is for us is going out there. I also think smoking is sometimes used as a weight management, possibly.
Yeah.
But then again, in the cast that I was in, like I said, it's not so much of an issue. I don't really know what causes that, but there was definitely a shift towards, well,
it coincides with a massive cultural change.
Cultural change, yeah, I agree. Yeah.
You saw fewer trendy, sexy celebrities even leaning into that and wanting to instead the cleaner image sort of a phase around a similar sort of time frame. But also it'd be interesting because, you know, that the downstream effects of smoking just beyond your obvious lung cancer, etc., of course, which are on the serious end of it, but it's kind of the association to bone health and stuff, especially amongst a professional class of dancer. I imagine that's starting to come through, and I know that that's coming through now in education of youngsters in that space. So a whole host of different factors, but again, one of the reasons I wanted to ask you about it is to see if that is still like a prevalence within a subculture, I heard before that it's gone by, there were always higher incidences in the performing arts of smokers than there would be in the general public for various reasons, whereas now it sounds like that's moved away.
I think it's tailing off, and I think that's to do with education, cultural shift, and probably to do with education, like the kind of thing that I do with the dancers that I see in their first year. And I think that more performing arts schools are doing that. They're getting professionals in to talk to people about health, nutrition, injury prevention, sleep, how to stay healthy as a performer. And I don't think you had that years ago.
No, so. I think as well, the incredible athletes that these people sometimes are just by disposition, and whilst they work incredibly hard, don't get me wrong, but the incredible levels of talent, as well as the fact that they sort of their body types, etc., have sort of lent them to this this world in which they sometimes have been able to do to a degree in their youth, take for granted some of the more holistic factors that they've otherwise just been able to do what they want, and their body can do these things, that those things are being taken less for granted in people's teens, from what I can gather. And as I say, your work has taught me as much on that as anyone. I think what I would wonder, just one last question on culture. with regards to the sort of high performance side of the performing arts, what, how much does the, is there any rock star style culture to it? So you mentioned the clock off at one and you mentioned bed by three. I can only imagine that especially the atmosphere, as well as the fact that that is something that is the celebration that can occur even on a show by show basis, and the adrenaline being high, is there not then a party culture that attaches to that influences
it? Yeah, no, I think there definitely is. I think you're right. It's probably worth bringing up mental health under this kind of bracket, because I think it's all part of it. It's definitely true that there's a bit of a party culture, but I think it depends on the type of person you are as to whether you get involved in that or not. Like, I learnt when I was in Paris, which was back in 2003, I learnt later on that there was probably a little bit of substance abuse that went on there. I don't know, can I say that? Yeah, there was. I was oblivious to it. I was like, oh, was there? So I just wasn't in that circle. So it's not a blanket thing for sure, you know. But if you're that way inclined, it's there for sure. I think when I spoke to our mental health nurse at the MTA where I work, so she's a mental health nurse and a counsellor, and I just kind of, we were just talking in general about why is it that performers have poorer mental health, because in general it's accepted that it's probably one in three performers that might have a problem with mental health in a year, whereas it's one in four, I think, for the general public. So there's a slightly higher incidence of problems. And she actually brought this up as one of the issues. It's that the environment supports two particular things. One is substance abuse, the other is probably sex addiction. Nice. That you do see in performers, for sure. And it's to do with low self-esteem and looking for validation, all of those kinds of things. And I think that the culture and the environment supports that if you want it. So I think that's the key thing. Like, I was never involved in that and I didn't really see it go on much, but it definitely does go on for sure. What else? I think just talking about mental health, I think if ever you see a dancer or someone who's in performance, it's not just dancers, this is musicians as well, actors, singers, it's always worth bearing in mind their mental health status, because they're under a lot of pressure. So they're under constant scrutiny. They have to compare themselves to people who maybe aren't in the arts and who are moving on through their life, having children, buying houses, that kind of thing. And yet they're still living in a bedsit or a bed, you know, a house share, you know, at the age of, say, 30, which is pretty standard, because you just don't make very much money doing what you do. You have to go from contract to contract, be highly flexible. There's a certain amount of resilience in there, but I think it takes its toll, I think, after years of rejections and having to be so flexible. And the other thing that I thought was really eye-opening that our mental health nurse shared with me was that when she counsels patients, it often goes back to their adolescence. So even though there are things about being in performance which are risky for mental health, you're very likely going into the world of performance because you're looking for validation or something like that, something from your adolescence is actually making you go into the arts because you've got low self-esteem, for example. So it's a bit of a, it's a hot pot for mental health type.
Chicken and egg.
It is chicken and egg, yeah.
Isn't it? Because you can so understand it, as well as understanding people's sort of disposition and character traits that might mean that they would be of the elite end of that spectrum, or even if not in terms of the quality of performance, but their want to do that, you know, it's something that you can so understand that is going to sort of self-select for certain traits. And
definitely
fascinating. I had a colleague who was in the a dancer that then went in and said didn't like really treating dancers, you know, they went into wanting team sports sort of athletes mainly and working in MSK. But when talking about dance, I said, just out of interest, if I'm thinking about treating in that direction, is there a particular sort of test or something you could do with a dance troupe, for example, that would be of value, and either what test would it be, and then especially if we were to act on it? And the reason I remember it is because I was sort of thinking in, at that point especially, I was thinking in like a basic screening level, and he just said, oh, a drugs test.
Oh, really?
Like, fundamentally, if you
really?
Which he saw as being the sort of people, I think I was asking after sort of longevity, you know, if you wanted to speak to dancers about, you know, how you couldn't, instead of having a real hot spot of a few years of a career, for those that wanted to 10, 15 years, I was saying what test and acting on said test yeah. would be, thinking endurance, etc. And he just said, no, it's the people.
It's interesting, though, because as someone who was in the industry for a really long time and I work with people all the time, I don't see it. It's not something that I see. I don't think I've ever seen it, actually. Like I said, it was probably around me a bit when I was a dancer, but I was a bit oblivious. I just wasn't in that circle. And I haven't really seen it when I've worked with dancers as a physio. So I think there's it might be a bit of a stereotype, but of course it's there for a reason, isn't it? You know,
yeah, potentially. No, it's interesting. And certainly something that we definitely don't want to paint with too broad a brush or make
it. No, for sure.
Direction. But for this and for the reason we're talking about it is because these are factors just to have in mind, you know, it's something that's well worth just considering those variables and especially for say that's conditions or substances that may influence physiology in a meaningful way that's relevant to why someone might be presenting or something's just not fitting.
Yes, yeah, 100%, yeah.
Developing a relationship in which you can at least tease those questions, ask those questions and tease things out in a really mature way that's professional.
Yes.
It's something that's well worth us even considering, even if it is just in 1% and therefore not, not representative. We just want to be bearing it in mind because it could be a factor influencing recovery.
And that's the whole point of talking about mental health, isn't it? I mean, I bring it up and I think, well, so what? But the point is that if there's a mental health problem, let's go with anxiety and depression, which is a rife for sure. Yeah. I see it in loads of the, when I do screening, you see a lot of it in the students that you meet. Why does it matter? Well, the point is it does interfere with recovery. It makes pain conditions more, it causes people to suffer more. It causes them to interpret things wrongly. It can extend injury times, all of that kind of stuff. So it is really, really applicable to us as physios. So that's why it's important. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. What I wonder then, if we can sort of talk about, because I think whilst we're talking about generalities in the space, I'd love to sort of go into the sort of flexibility meets hypermobility sort of discussion, because it's something that foam rolling and massage being part of the culture, then incessant stretching, or what are essentially not stretches, they're just demonstrations of flexibility that almost become part of the routine that you see a dancer do, when fundamentally they're taking themselves to an end range that's never been in question. You know, these are incredibly flexible people. Is that something that is just, you know, a harmless habit, or is that sometimes pathological?
Okay, so when it comes to flexibility, there's almost two schools of thought, I always think, of the way that we understand that people increase their range of motion after a course of stretching. So you've got your architectural changes, which is that the muscle is actually increasing in length by adding of sarcomeres to increase the fascicle length. So that's one way. And the other way is the stretch tolerance theory. And when I first learned about that, I found it really fascinating, because a lot of my life I've spent stretching and trying to become more flexible. So learning that actually it might not just be about getting the muscles to be longer was a really interesting concept to me. And if you ask a group of dancers, like I often do, why do you think you get more flexible after you've been stretching for a while, they will pretty much 100% of the time say, oh, because the muscles get longer. But I think that's just a general population understanding, you know. So what I say, of course, they're not wrong, because there's evidence to support that, isn't there? But what I always say to them is, you're right, but I think it might be more complicated than that. Because we also think it might be just the way that you start to get used to it. And it's called stretch tolerance. And I tell them about it. Mm. And
the
I think
with just on that, though, the dancers, they're one of a few groups that actually will probably lengthen. Because they actually do often sustain. Because that's the thing, it's usually a misnomer, because people are like bouncing into a hamstring stretch for 8 seconds and stuff like that three times. Whereas with dancers, they probably do meet the threshold in which they probably are adding it. So it's not necessarily a myth, but it's also not the mechanism that's making the most difference.
Possibly. Well, it probably is in some cases, but you're absolutely right. Like, how many populations actually spend at least an hour a day stretching in some capacity, you know? And that's the criticism of the studies, isn't it? Like, but who's going to do that, you know? Yes. So it's a really good population to kind of see that in. And the key thing about the architectural changes is that in general, the literature would say you need to make it intense. So you're looking at, 7 or 8 out of 10 for discomfort, because you're trying to get plastic deformation of the muscles. So, and I think that's the way the dancers think too. It's that no pain, no gain thing, 100%. So... Right. they push hard into their stretches and they work really hard at it, and they think the more this hurts, the better it's going to be. And in a lot of cases, they will get more flexible. However, this is coming from a personal point of view with me as well, because I was always flexible enough to be a dancer. So I've obviously got a certain level just genetically, but I was never one of those really super bendy dancers. What I used to get was through the course of either a rehearsal period or like a term when I was a student, I'd start and I'd feel pretty good. I'd be able to kick my leg and it wouldn't feel too bad. And then as the weeks went on, I'd almost get stiffer in my attempt to try and increase my flexibility. And if you talk to dancers, lots of them will report this, which is really interesting, because you're, like you said, you're in that cohort where they should be the ones that are really seeing the changes in the muscles. So why would they feel stiffer? But I was definitely one of those people. So this is why when I read about stretch tolerance, it really kind of called out to me, because it seems to be that for me, the harder I try and stretch, I almost have like it backfires on me a little bit. And that seems to be more to do with the neurodynamics of it. So if you get a dancer come to see you with this kind of problem, this is what I've started doing in the last few years, and I've had some really good outcomes with it. It's worth testing their end of range flexibility to see where the restriction lies. So is it in the hamstrings or is it neural? Because with some of them, when you do a passive straight leg raise on them, they don't feel it in the hamstring, and they actually feel it behind the knee or in the calf. Well, we know that that's a neural stretch, isn't it? So if their restriction is neural, you probably need to work with the nervous system more than people right. that don't have that kind of sensation. And that's me. This is why I find it really interesting, because I have personal experience with this.
Just on that, would you look for, because you're mentioning almost a subjective guide and an objective guide there.
Yeah.
You're assessing and our listeners are assessing dancers, and they may be wanting to try and tease that out, which would be interesting. Would you be looking for one or both of those things? So you've got that they might have that neurodynamically when you test them on a passive straight leg raise or equivalent.
Yeah.
And you're also looking for this, when you persistently stretch over the course of a term, do you notice positive or negative changes? So you're needing one or both of those things, do you think?
Probably one or both, but usually you get both together.
Right.
Like I only did the talk with our new first years at the MTA 2 weeks ago, and I said, "Does anyone here experience that?" And about 5 hands flew up.
It's
a definite phenomenon, and it was something that happened to me. So it's really frustrating as a dancer when you're trying to get your flexibility better, but it kind of seems to backfire on you. So if you switch your mentality, go towards more stretch tolerance rather than trying to actually make the muscles longer. So by doing that, if you back off on the intensity, if you don't hold any stretches, so dancers will do static stretching. We know there's evidence for and against it, blah, blah, blah. But in these particular types of people, if you don't hold stretches, you make them more dynamic, and you almost treat them like a radicular pain patient, right?
Right.
You're almost getting them to kind of slide and glide in tension.
Okay.
If you think about how we do that in clinic. So you're like a slump test. So you'll get them to go into a full stretch and pull the toes up and maybe put the head down, but then you'll come straight back out of it. So you're kind of flossing the nerve as opposed to tensioning the nerve.
Sure. Yeah? And we're not suggesting then, because this is one of the things that the misnomer in the neurodynamics literature is this, we're not inferring that we need to literally stretch the nervous system as if that web is tight. We're saying that the interfaces, as we know, between the nervous system and the musculature and all the other soft tissues, we're trying to just create more mobility. So instead of sustaining a stretch, we're then flowing in and out of different movements and sometimes even considering neurodynamic patterns if we needed to.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because you're never going to just stretch the nerves in isolation, are you? And are we stretching nerves? I don't even know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
for sure.
You're never going to do anything in isolation. Everything's going to happen all at once. So it's just a different way of stretching. So I've done a couple of videos though on YouTube about how to assess this and also how to change the flexibility program to be more useful for people that might find normal stretching, quote unquote, less productive, right? So if you want to have a look at this, some YouTube videos that might explain it a bit better, but it's just it's a really useful thing with some dancers. But you also find this so you get lots of hypermobility in dance. It's definitely, I think they say as much as 44% of dancers can be hypermobile. That I definitely have read that somewhere. However, the instance of hypermobility will drop as you move up through the ranks, and that's probably a self-selection type thing. So basically, if you're really hypermobile, you're probably not going to have the strength and control to be able to be a prima dancer in the Royal Ballet.
Okay.
You know? So
what about longevity? Do we know anything about that with regards to, say, hypermobility? Does that predispose to a short career?
Yeah, possibly. And that's, again, why you don't find it at higher levels.
Right.
Because those people will potentially have already gotten to the end of their career. They just have too much joint pain, or they're just not able to sustain postures or whatever it is. So
sure.
Yes, there's possibly, okay, that's possibly why as well. But people have this assumption that hypermobile people are flexible, but they're not always. Very often I'll get someone, often I had three in the last cohort that have just come into the musical theatre academy that I work at, who rates, let's say, an 8 out of 9 on the Beighton scale. So all of their joints will go to maximum range. But if you get them to stand and try and touch the floor, they can't do it. And it's just really bizarre, because, and they get so annoyed because they're like, I've got all of the cons of being hypermobile and none of the pros, you know, because it's like, I think it was Nick Allen who is like the head physio. I think he's a physio for the Birmingham Ballet. He did a really good lecture about this, and that's on YouTube if you want to have a look at it. But he basically lists the pros and the cons of hypermobility. The pros are increased range of motion. The cons, he's got like three different lists of all the problems that come with hypermobility. So to have hypermobility syndrome and not be flexible is just a double assault, isn't it, really? So this kind of stretching is really, really useful for those people as well. So it's just it's a useful way to kind of look at people's flexibility who actually do need to be able to kick high. You know, like footballers don't necessarily, or well, maybe footballers more than a runner, but you know what I mean, in the general athletic population. And then go, just talking about the hypermobile population, just to finish, you get those hypermobile dancers that are so flexible you can't believe it. And this is, I see this often. It's the kind of flexibility I'm talking about is probably a little bit rarer. This is the kind where you'll have them on the plinth, you'll take them into a passive straight leg raise, and I'm not kidding, you'll go from nothing to 12 o'clock, so their leg is up next to their ear with zero resistance. It's like, you can't even describe, I'm not like that at all. My leg will go to about 110 degrees and then I'm like, oh. So to feel that sort of level of absolutely no resistance is really incredible. But then you see what they can do and you think, well, of course. And I've got quite an interesting case study. I was working with a girl in the West End who was in a show. She was hired for her flexibility. And there was a particular piece that she had to do and she had to kick. And in the course of a month, she made her nose bleed twice. Because she kicked her nose, basically. So she kicked and bashed her face and the leg came down. So she,
if you think about it, hard, hasn't she? She's not just
really
clipped
hard.
As it decelerates either.
Yeah, she properly, and so that's part of the reason that she came to see me. She said, I don't think I can keep doing this. So to have a look at why that was happening, you have to look at their proprioception, don't you? Because she's clearly got no understanding of where her leg is in space. So if you get them lying on a plinth and you say to them, so I use clock face training, which is probably kind of self-explanatory. But if you imagine they're lying and then their feet are at, say, 6 o'clock and their head's at 12, and you say to them, okay, take your leg to 3 o'clock, which would be a 90-degree stretch, right? Can they do it? Are they accurate? This girl would take her leg nearly to 1 o'clock, like 1, 2 o'clock. So she'd go way past the point that she thought she needed to when I asked her to take her leg to a certain place. Does that make sense?
Are you doing that, would say, with her eyes closed? Or you mean it even?
With eyes closed. Sorry, yeah, eyes closed.
No, it's all right, because I can still see the utility of her, even if she had her eyes closed and you had to do it quickly. And you think it'd still be a useful exercise, but I see what you mean. And you're getting her to close her eyes and she's just not got that. She's not getting the, what we'll classically consider joint space, but actually she's not getting the proprioception from the musculature, is she either?
No.
So we sometimes use
that
joint position sense with the shoulder, don't we? And we're thinking about it just as joint position sense. But actually, if she's not got that resistance in her hamstring, as she does that, then I can understand
what she got to tell her. Yeah, and you can see why she's in this position where she's hit her face so hard. Yeah. So the training that we ended up doing, so I basically said to her, look, do you stretch? And she's like, oh yeah, I stretch all the time. And I'm thinking, my God, it's like those pictures you see on Instagram of gymnasts with their feet on one chair and another chair and their body's down in the middle. They're in an overstretched position. And it's very impressive, but actually, they're the last people that need to be working on passive end of range mobility. You know, they need to be working on that kind of range of motion with strengthening and control so that they can place their leg there. And a lot of them can, like if you look at a rhythmic gymnast, they can place their leg there. But some of them, for example, you kick, you've got the momentum of the leg as well, haven't you? So trying to control that is slightly different from taking the leg up slowly. So it's just to give you an example of the real extremes of flexibility and how it's not always beneficial, and how you have to train strength and control into their, in, you have to get them to do that as part of their conditioning work, basically, so that it actually improves the aesthetics. It makes them look better when they dance. And that's one way to get buy-in sometimes. You say to them, look, if you do this extra training, it will look better when you kick. The audience won't kind of wince because your leg is ricocheting off your face. You know, so there's actually aesthetic gains as well. And of course, that's the most important thing, because dance is an artistic, it's an art form. So
a touring performer probably a couple of years ago under a sort of consulting role before we had the practice, but saw face to face because she was local, you know, doing they were in town and came to see me. Because I was then not able to really give some of the rehab that I would want to be more involved, some of the control based stuff that we've sort of talked about, I remember sort of saying that we'll have a catch up over Skype at the time. But in the meantime, I just feel like some of the things that you're describing basically sort of maps onto her. And I said, just go and train with the synchronized swimming team that she said your housemate was in. And it was like, it felt like if you can just do some of these movements under some sense of resistance in which you're not having to, you know, she wasn't decelerating sensibly and stuff. And it felt like in that instance, you could do the same thing. You had a rhythmic gymnast in that instance to go and, go and do some synchronized swimming, or vice versa, just as a means of cross training, where you might use that range in a different way.
Yeah,
it was cop out rehab from me between appointments in many ways, but the concept is that you've just got the range is sometimes it can be a negative rather than just a positive. Like
you 100%. If you, for sure. And I don't think people ever think that this is one of the. So I list these myths for the new students when they come in, and one of them is, the myth is, I can't be too flexible. That's what I tell them. So it doesn't apply to many of them. Most of them will be trying to get more flexible most of their careers, just like I was. But for the ones that don't have to, it's a really important thing to explain.
Yeah, and also for them to be reassured that they're not suddenly going to stiffen up. They're not going to miss a couple of days worth of hour-long static stretching and then wake up stiff and therefore not able to perform as they are.
Yeah, definitely.
And they'd expect their body to. You know, that's just not how it works and what we understand of it now. Whereas I think historically we used to think that, you know, you need to do this to maintain.
Yeah.
There maybe are some people that do, but those that are dispositionally that way, then we need to probably reassure them that there's probably better things you could be doing with that hour.
Definitely. But what you just said, something I wanted to pick up on. The thing about hypermobiles deconditioning, just not to do with flexibility, but when it comes to strength and conditioning and power, they do decondition faster. They seem to. So it's really important for them to know if they have a break, they probably shouldn't have a complete rest when it comes to strength work.
Right. Okay.
So that's something that I always talk to them about as well.
No, it makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, obviously, I still dance professionally. I did it for 15 years, but I could have enjoyed my dance more and I could have performed better if I had cross-trained, done strength training, stretched differently. And probably just those main things. That's probably enough. I worked on my single leg heel raise strength. That's the other thing that I want to make sure goes into this podcast.
I know where we can go there. I mean, I was going to definitely bring it there at some point because of the fact that you mentioned about these sort of calf injuries, especially in the male dancers, etc. But also the calves are doing plenty in most types of dance, but especially when it comes to, say, musical theatre, etc. There's, you know, I rarely see someone come on stage without it being a leap. So, you know, you've got that nature of the bounding that's often quite dramatic. And that is going to be conducive to not just overuse in terms of tendons, et cetera, but certainly those high impact strains when it comes to lifting. So I suppose it depends if you want to nest your answer as to why a single leg calf raise you feel is valuable. But also tell me a little bit about some of the more specific injuries that can occur that aren't just overuse.
Okay, so calf and ankle injuries don't just happen because of the impact work and the jumping. You also have to consider footwear as well, and also because of, if you think about dancers that work on points, so standing on their toes, you get loads of posterior impingements. I'm trying to think of the other thing I was going to say. Oh, heels. So apart from point shoes, dancers also dance in heels. I can't think of another sport where someone's required to wear a heeled shoe to do the thing that they're going to do. So this is a big part of my dance career because I did Latin ballroom and Argentine tango. So I spent a lot of my career in heels. And you hear stories about dancers who train all day in heels, and then they take their heels off, go to the gym for a run or something, and they get calf strain. Or the worst case was an Achilles tendon rupture. And you can probably see where I'm going to go with this. It's because it's worked in that shortened range for, what, 8 hours maybe of a rehearsal. And then you're asking it to accept the body's load at the extended range, which it doesn't work in, which it's not trained to do. So it's really important to have full strength through the full range of the calf complex. And so the single leg heel raise is really important for ballet dancers because of the amount of work they do in a point position. It's really important for all dancers because of the amount of elevation and landing that we have to deal with. And it's really important for other dancers, say heel people that work in heels, because they often don't train the full range of their motion with strength. So I was talking about this on Twitter, and then I had a really lovely tweet back from Sue Mays, who I'd like to just mention because she's always so gracious and always, if ever I have any questions, she's always straight there and gives me loads of help. Sue Mays is the medical director for the Australian Ballet. Very knowledgeable, very experienced. And I was talking about doing single leg heel raises. I think I was doing it with dancers because I'd seen it done by someone who worked with runners as a functional measure. So what you get with a lot of student dancers is medial tibial stress syndrome, loads of it. In fact, before we moved to our new location with the MTA, the theatre school, we were in an old building that had concrete floors. And I'm not kidding, I think we had 60% of the dancers had shin splints, basically, because of the amount of work they were doing on a really unforgiving floor. And it was just an absolute nightmare. And then in one of the shows they were doing a number from Legally Blonde, the musical Legally Blonde, which is a skipping number. So they've all got skipping ropes, and the whole number is them skipping. So they'd been skipping all day on this concrete floor. They weren't used to it. Everyone got shin splints, basically. So I was trying to tailor my treatments a little bit better because it was something that came up so often, and also I was trying to think up a prevention program as well, because even though the students pay me, so this is interesting, I'm not paid by the college, I'm paid by the students.
Right.
Some bigger colleges have physios that work full-time for them. Now our college is so small that they unfortunately they can't afford to do that. They do pay me to come and do assessments at the beginning, and they pay me to do the injury chat at the beginning, but after that the students have to pay me. So students don't have a lot of money. So I always see part of my job is actually trying to get them to see me less. So I was trying to come up with this basically a prevention program for medial tibial stress syndrome, but all the other foot and ankle condition problems. So Sue May sent me this information about a single leg heel raise program that they use with their dancers at the Australian Ballet. And it's really concise. They implemented it, and they found that their rate of injury dropped significantly. Basically, calf injuries, posterior impingement, and foot injuries dropped when they put this for all the dancers to do. And the way that they implement it is they do it once the dancers are fatigued. So once they've done their bar work, do you know what I mean when I say bar work?
Yeah.
So it's when you've got the dancers stand at the side, they have their hand on the bar, and it's a set sort of load of exercises which build you up to get to the center to do the dances where you're actually moving freely around the room. So once they finish their bar work, they then bring in the single leg heel raise exercise. You use a metronome, you set it at 60 beats per minute, and you get the dancers to go in parallel, so it doesn't look like a dance exercise. Fingers resting lightly on a bar, you're going to just go up, down, up, down. So in parallel, good alignment, completely extended knee. And you basically go to fatigue. This is when they're already fatigued, okay? And it gives them a measure of their calf endurance. And what Sue came up with after assessing their dancers and after doing this for a number of months is a number of about 25. So dancers that can do 25 calf raises in a fatigued state have pretty good calf endurance and are less likely to get injured. And I just thought that was fascinating. I thought it's such an easy thing to implement. So I emailed the dance teachers, I put a video together, I put it online, and I got all the kids doing it. And it has helped. Some of them, it's improved their jump strength, it's improved, it's reduced some injury rates. I don't keep a really clear record of injuries in the same way as some
doctors they will have over at the Australian.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't like the bigger ballet companies tend to have documents and they write exactly what happens when, and they're able to audit that better probably than I am. But I just thought, well, why wouldn't you do that with a dancer, with a load of dancers?
It leans into that. It's a classic thing where we think about shock absorption.
What a perfect
muscle apparatus it is to do that. But sometimes it's seen as being like a bit of a go-to get out of jail type thing where it's almost too cliched. But in this instance, it not only sounds like it's a sensible and feasible mechanism, but actually the interventional studies such as this, or you know, what's then carried through on audits for this is troops then, but I don't know what teams
for the dancers.
But it's great that those sorts of levels of evidence are really valuable for us to get insight, especially because, I mean, I can only imagine it's going to be easy for them. Put the metronome on. They're going to keep to time, I think, dancers.
Put
them in a gym full of rugby players. It'd be hilarious to see them bobbing up and down. But no, I can see how that would work, as well as, you know, it's great to hear of those sorts of results. So, yeah, it's fascinating because you were reflecting on your own experiences, saying that of the things that you would change, then that would be one of them.
Yeah.
Implement, and it's great.
And it's one of the things. So now, in fact, after the recent, so we just had a new cohort start for September at our theatre school. So I've recently been doing a load of videos to give them some resources of the most important things. So on those videos, and this is people that can use these as resources from the podcast, are neurodynamic stretching, testing to see whether flexibility is limited by muscle, fascia, or possibly the nervous system. I've got foundation core exercises. I'm about to put the single leg heel raise video up, that kind of thing. So they've got these basic resources of stuff that almost all dance students will benefit from, in my experience, and professionals as well. It's amazing when you see, when you work with professionals, like in the West End, if you get them to do a single leg heel raise and you just get them to balance on your hands, how difficult it is for a lot of them just to get up and stay up. They don't have the endurance that they need to be able to perform, especially on things like rate stages, which are an absolute minefield.
But you've said that about control generally, haven't you, before? Depending on the style of dance that they do, etc., means that unlike when you're with a gymnast, that the change in speed that is inherent to a lot of gymnastic training means that they tend to have control at every which angle. Whereas when it comes to sort of dance and performance, sometimes, especially if they've been in a show for a while, from what I've seen as well, is that you've got certain tasks that are far less challenging than the one that they're doing all the time, in a technical sense. But it's so undertrained because they're doing it in one particular rate, at one particular speed, at frequency, and therefore actually a step down from that under a controlled environment is really challenging for them. But do you think
that's it? And that's why they get injured. Yeah, definitely, Jack. There is one bit of research, and it's you saying that your niece goes to Elmhurst is what made me think about it. But it's just they did some fantastic research about strength and conditioning for reducing injuries in dancers that I just feel like I want to say. It's something that I've mentioned in a blog that I've written previously, but it's so good, and I just think it's worth a shout out. So what they did was they took the FIFA 11 plus, which is designed for footballers, they adapted it for dancers, and then they instilled it into their program at Elmhurst Ballet School. And then once that was instilled and all the dancers had done it, they then, I don't know what the time period was, but they had a 40% reduction in injury in reportings of injuries from putting in this strength and conditioning program that's based on the FIFA 11 plus, and they call it the 11 plus dance. And it's on YouTube. So if you want to Google it, just put in 11 plus dance, and it's beautifully filmed. They've got dancers performing each of the exercises. They've got, you know, do this exercise, make sure that you can do this, 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 and this before you progress. It's really well explained. So it's a brilliant resource. I use it myself. I pick exercises out of it for some things, and some people I'll say, go away and do that. Like if they want to strength and conditioning program, because it's evidence-based. The paper hasn't been published, I think, much to their dismay, but I think I might even be right in saying they won an award for that. I might be wrong. I think I read that somewhere. So I wanted to just mention it because I think it was such fantastic research.
Well, let's draw some attention to it, and whether or not that means it gets chalked up, but let's get some fanfare around it. That sounds like really interesting work, and certainly the sort of application of an adaptation of sensible evidence-informed metrics and that sort of data is really valuable, and I think sometimes under regarded. You know, it's like that sort of active audit type processes that then result in changes. They're the sorts of things that should be done on levels of departments, all levels of sport. So really interesting stuff, and thanks for mentioning it. You said you train into that control in various different various different ways, which reminds me a bit, you know, we go back to the can-can, and you think about the work that Kieran O'Sullivan did on hamstrings and recognising that in Irish, Gaelic footballers, the way that they kick, obviously, on a straight leg means that that's asking a lot eccentrically of a hamstring, much like a can-can would. Is that you've really got the... It's about the, you know, the flexibility to get there. Okay, that's one thing, but the actual ability to control and decelerate that movement is key.
And the can-can, it's not just how high the leg goes, it's how quick you can get it down, because it's really fast. So it's exactly what you've just said.
Decelerating the eccentric and then snapping it back.
Snapping it down. And with a flexed foot. So you're doing it with a flexed foot. So you're technically putting the nerve under a massive amount of stress as well. So it's like just a recipe for disaster. It was for me. My hamstrings were never the same again. So it's exactly what you just described. Yeah. And I think that's the key thing, is that that's the kind of thing that you might not realize. People always train because they want to be more flexible. But what about getting a leg back down? Because this is another thing I wanted to mention about dancers and how dance is different from other sports. And you said about the metronome. There's no other sports that I can think of, again, that have an external rhythm that you have to keep up to.
Yeah.
You know? So if you're running, you're just going to go as fast as you can. But actually, and if you were just going to do kicks, you'd just do them at a certain speed. But it's dictated to you how fast you've got to do them to get across the stage and be in the right place and blah, blah, blah. Sure. So working with music or with a metronome is really important, I think, for rehab in dancers as well, because it's how they work. It's how they're asked to produce movement to an external rhythm. And metronomes are really useful for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that funnily enough, brings me on to a concept of compliance, is something that I've heard it called in the arts, whereby even the metronome, as you've just mentioned, is something that, or the rhythm, is something that complies that athlete within, you know, there's a certain degree of freedom that might be in the creative arts, in the choreography processes, and that people can have their individual style. But then there is compliance within form. I mean, more so in ballet, don't get me wrong. I've got a niece at Elmhurst at the moment who...
Have you? Okay, yeah.
Well, but, you know, it's just so fascinating that she's seen as being fairly edgy as a ballerina from what I've told. But, you know, to my naked eye, it's just like, if anything, it's so compliant amongst the whole group. But it's just that the compliance aspects, and the reason that this word came up in conversation with others, was that also means that they all get this association to the links to this show must go on mentality, whereby they sometimes grin and bear it. They comply within the expectations of their coaches, their teachers, the audience, themselves, the fact that they're in it to be under the spotlight, and they love that. Hopefully they enjoy that. That they then comply within the expectations that mean that they're sometimes willing to put themselves through it for various reasons in ways that they probably shouldn't in some instances. Mm-hmm. I wonder what your thoughts are on that, whether the culture is changing, but also how we as therapists need to interact and better understand it, because we need to not be clumsy and say, don't do it. But then also you sometimes need to push hard when it is for safety reasons, to potentially pull people off stress fractures that are worse than and other
variables. Yeah. Okay. So I think, there's definitely this kind of, this air about dancers where, like the phrase you said, like the show must go on, no matter what happens, you go on and you perform, you dance through pain, that kind of thing. And I think that can be the mentality of some dancers, because they are very, they want to do well, they're perfectionists, that kind of thing. But actually the way that things are set up, certainly at a more professional level and in bigger companies, is it's kind of set up so that doesn't have to happen. So if you go into theatres in the West End, they've got a really clear structure of they have swings, understudies and standbys who are there to step in if anyone in the show can't go on, basically. And they're used constantly. And if all of them are in use, you can then do things called, you can cut the show, basically. So you can take parts out that won't really matter, you can move people around so that the show can still go on but still protect the health of the individuals that are in it. And at a very professional level, that's what happens. And that was a big part of what my job was and is. I say was, because I unfortunately, because of COVID, I'm not working in theatres this summer, which I would have been, but that was a big part of my job. So you get a dancer come in to see you. So they've just done one show, they've done the matinee, they're about to go on for the evening, but can they? So I can't think of an example. So they've got knee pain. So you're going to assess it. Is it something that really needs to not be danced on? In which case you speak to the company manager, who speaks to the dance captain, who sorts it out. So they've got the facility to be able to do that. Otherwise, if it's something, so say they're just a bit sore around the joint, they've overdone it a little bit, you do a bit of manual therapy because actually we know it's going to help them get through the second show. This is a kind of comes back to that reliance on adjuncts and massage. So I still use that with dancers because I think it's really useful because they live show to show. And when they come and see you, if you can put your hands on them and help them, as long as they're not at risk, like say you, obviously you don't do this with a stress fracture suspected, but something else like a achy muscle or a sore joint. If you can put your hands on them to help get them through the next show, not only are they incredibly grateful to you, but you've just saved a lot of work and it doesn't, you know, you can do that. I think that's one of the really interesting things about MSK Physio, isn't it? You can create immediate changes. They're short term, but they don't need to be long term. You're just trying to get them from show to show at certain levels.
The form of pain relief.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I really backfired. The pendulum swung completely the opposite direction for me once I'd done my physio training, because I thought, oh, but it doesn't work. It's only short term. It's not valid. So I used to take my hands off a little bit, and now I'm back to doing what I used to do, but I use the time that I'm with performers to educate them about why things work, what else they can do, how they can prevent it in the future. And I think it's really valid, and I think it's also expected. And I think that's why if you work with performers, you need to have good hands-on. You just need to be good at doing hands-on, basically, because it's expected and it's used a lot in the industry. I think this idea of working through the pain and performing no matter what, it's always a shared decision. So long as that dancer knows that they're not going to make themselves worse. So for example, if we've got a suspected stress fracture, they're not going to go on no matter what. And I'll speak to the company manager and say they can't dance. This is why we'll refer them on for the relevant management of it. If it's not something as serious as that, then it's still their decision, but it's going to be a shared process with me. How might it be worse? What might the repercussions be? What can I do in the meantime? That kind of thing. And I think then you just make that decision together. But there's always that provision for them not to go on if they don't have to, in general, I would say. And then at lower levels or at student levels, I think it's just a case of learning when to push through and when it's just something like DOMS, or when not to push through, like if you've got bony pain, that kind of thing. And for example, you say your niece is at Elmhurst. Yeah, so she'll be there with the relevant medical team, so they should advise her appropriately. I think as a culture, we're not asking dancers to push through pain as much as possibly in the past.
Well, that's one of the things I was going to ask, is that you kind of, again, it's one of the things that someone outside of the dance world means that you're sometimes even playing on Hollywood stereotypes now of dance teachers of old and sort of the association sometimes even to, you know, Russian gymnastic teachers and stuff, and the cliches that come from overstretching and sometimes asking too much of athletes and things that aren't fair. And I'm not suggesting are representative now, but it's just that I imagine that there is a difference in expectation, but also hopefully a difference in judgment level for people that are needing to opt out of certain things at certain times rather than be considered a symptom of weakness or some mental fragility. Whereas hopefully if we're being thoughtful, is that coming in now?
I think so. Yeah, for sure. Even with the inclusion of things like understanding the importance of mental health, all of those things, I think healthcare in general is much more inclusive, or we think about everything now. And if someone's you have to think about why might someone be pushing to go on stage, or why might they not be pushing to go on stage is the other thing. So you often get dancers who are constantly injured or constantly in pain, and yet objectively they shouldn't be, and they're the ones that also ring alarm bells. So that's when you have to start thinking about, do they want to be here? Are they self-jeopardizing? That kind of thing. So you both ends of the spectrum, I think, as well. Yeah.
Awesome. That's really interesting. Now, just to wrap up then, Liz, I just wondered if you can give us some top tips as to what you feel, especially a general MSK audience, should be really bearing in mind as when they see dancers of any level presenting to them.
Top tips. Okay. So if you get a dancer in, I suppose key things to look at are, like you were saying, they might be able to do really amazing feats, leaps, jumps, that kind of thing, but look at their basic strength and control in simple body movements. So single leg heel raises, single leg knee bends, squats, bridges, single leg bridges, push-ups, rowing, planks, all of those kinds of things, because they show up inconsistencies and imbalances that you might not be expecting to see. And also dancers quite like being tested in that way, in my experience. So I sort of always say to people, I don't have this sort of Bible of exercises and tests that I do just with dancers. Sure. I do all the same stuff with dancers as I do with the average person as well. There's a few things that are more specific, particularly in the exercises, but in general, I'll get them to be doing lunges or functional tests, that kind of thing, to look at their strength and control on a whole, because quite often that can be quite revealing. The single leg heel raise is a classic, I tell you. And I think that with everyone, I think probably with runners and things as well, it's a really, really good test. I think be mindful of their options for modifying their dance. So at a really high level, if they're injured, like I said, there's those things in place that they can be taken out of the show and that can be replaced. If they're at a lower level, it probably isn't as important. It isn't as important that they go on, but they can probably modify choreography or teaching style or, say for example, you've got someone that's in a local show. So that's not the kind of thing where it's been choreographed by a professional person and it must always be the same every night. That can probably be tweaked. So it's about asking them, what are our options here? Can we modify things? Can you do it on the other leg? Can you take the back bend out? You know, things like that. So if you speak to them about what the options are, it might give you an idea of what you can change to either keep them dancing or get them back to dancing sooner as well. So the other thing is with dancers is that they might not return to full dance, but they can return to some dance. So know what your options are there as well. So you, rather than doing a full out, say, ballet class, you can do what's called a flat bar. So you don't rise up at all. So for foot and ankle injuries, it's fantastic. They can get back to class, but they're not going to be necessarily exacerbating their injury. Or you can do a low bar. So you don't go up to full rise, you just keep it low. Or you can do the whole class, but you can take out the jumps at the end, you know, that kind of thing. So you need to know what their options are. What else? Always bear mental health in mind. It's just something to kind of have in the back of your mind for if you're looking at someone who has really severe symptoms that don't really match up to the objective things that you're seeing, or global pain. Always look for hypermobility. That's not something that's been that they know about. Always have a quick check with dancers for hypermobility, because if they're having lots of different joint problems, that could be why. Obviously there's other reasons. What else? And check their, ask them about their other exercise. That's the key, because I think lots of dancers think the more I dance the better I'll be, but actually, rather than doing two dance classes a day, do a dance class, then go away, do 45 minutes of cardio and some strength training, and that'll do you much better, much less likely to get overuse injuries, and you'll benefit as a dancer from it as well, I think.
Yeah, especially if you're doing those dance classes as for fitness rather than for technique or for learning. And
yeah,
different world, isn't it? Now, yeah. As I thought would happen, you know, we've come back around to this, some principles there that people need to recognise to apply MSK. So in occupational health or in other rehabilitation, they'd be recognizing, take the whole task, break it down, recognize what return to work would look like in terms of, can you do modified duties, can we look at the macro load, or specific tasks that we can modify and give people variations of. Applying those principles into a dance world sounds appropriate, and then recognizing where the upper limit is to your knowledge to make sure you don't make some clumsy mistakes, especially in the high level. That seems like a really decent place for us to have concluded it. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. It's been absolutely fascinating. And I know we could talk about this forever and a day. So no doubt we can talk again in another context. But thanks so much, and really appreciate it. Where do people find more out about you, Liz?
So just look up my name. If you Google me, you'll get my dance stuff and my physio stuff. So if you want to see me dancing, you can see that too. So Liz Bailey, Bailey spelt with a Y, B-A-Y-L-E-Y. Liz Bailey Physio is my website. I've got a YouTube channel. So if you want to have a look at some of the videos I've been talking about for, dynamic stretching or core work or how to assess people's flexibility and improve it, that's all on there. You can have a look at that. And I should probably just do a shout in the direction of the NHS dance clinics, because I don't think people know much about this, and it's a really fantastic resource. So London, Bath, Birmingham, there's NHS dance clinics at big hospitals that GPs can refer your patients into with the choose and book option. And then they're fantastic. They're clinics with, so you've got sports medicine doctors, physios, nurses, psychologists, they've got pain management or access to all of those services. So if you have a dancer who you see on the NHS or privately who doesn't have the funds and needs further input or a second opinion or anything like that, or scans, NHS dance clinics, and you get to them via One Dance and NIDDIMS, and that's the National Institute of Dance Medicine Science. That's who runs it. And they can, people can be referred straight there. And they even have, like in London, the hospital is in Mile End, they even have a A&E department for dancers. So if you've got a dancer that requires an emergency scan, or they might have had a fracture or something like that, you can send them to Mile End in London, phone ahead, details are on the web, and they'll see a dance specialist, hopefully. Wow. So long as the service is still running. I don't know if COVID has affected things.
Sure, that could be. Yeah. No, that's brilliant. Well, that's really helpful information and signposting as well. So thanks again. Really appreciate it. And we'll speak soon.
Thanks, Jack. Bye.
And there we have it, session 83. Can you believe it? We're getting through them. We're soon that 100th episode, 100 months. Looking forward to it. We need to try and work out what to do for that celebration, don't we? Got a little bit of time yet, of course. So yeah, many thanks to those of you that tuned in last time for feedback. I hope we can get similar sort of levels of that for this episode. It's a fascinating conversation, and there's some extra time that's on Physio Matters Plus that we'll be able to bring you from this chat about the specifics of what it might mean in musical theatre, and how what people are asking of their bodies as athletes and artists, essentially, that really can influence their movement behaviours. It's a real niche conversation that we went into, but really fascinating for how that will help you to treat this style of athlete. So many thanks to Liz, many thanks to you all. Do check out the websites as I described, therapy-live.co.uk. Please have a drive around that and get your feedback in, as well as physio-matters.com for all things Physio Matters Plus. So thanks a lot to everyone, and I leave you with our cheesy sign out that Liz was quite delighted to do. See you next time.
You're listening to the Physio Matters podcast, discussing physio matters because physio matters.